Welcome to the Quantum Feedback Loop podcast. I'm your host, James Myers, and I also publish The Quantum Record, which features the latest in science and technology. As 2024 draws to a close, we can reflect on the record-setting number of elections that were held this year in over 60 countries, as well as the European Union, in which nearly half of the world's voting age population had a chance to cast a ballot. Fairness and the democratic process suffered in some of these elections, highlighting the need for public trust in preserving democracy. With a spotlight this year on democracy and its challenges, it was a privilege to discuss with Dr. Ian Battista his work as an election monitor and the evolving effects of technology on democratic processes. Ian holds a PhD in political science and since 2021 has served as a consultant to the Carter Center. The subject of Ian's doctoral thesis was electoral manipulation and democratic backsliding, and he has served as a visiting researcher at the University of Notre Dame and professor of international relations at the University Estácio do Recife in Brazil. Ian speaks about the crucial role that election monitoring can play in maintaining or re-establishing public trust in voting, but how in today's technological era there are more tactics available for bad actors to rig elections well in advance. In his work for the Carter Center, which was established by former U.S. President Jimmy Carter in 1982, shortly after he left office, Ian has monitored three elections on two continents. In our discussion, you'll hear him describe what it's like on the ground in some particularly tense situations, and the effects of technological changes that can sometimes hinder and sometimes help the democratic process. Well, Ian, welcome to the Quantum Feedback Loop podcast. Really interesting to talk to you about monitoring elections and your history in terms of understanding the political processes. So welcome. And I understand that you've been involved in monitoring three elections on two continents. So maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about your work and what the process of election monitoring involves, and how many people there are involved in the process.
Of course. First of all, thanks for having me, James. So I've been working in electoral observation since 2022. I've been to Brazil, Tunisia, and now Venezuela this year. The process of electoral observation involves, international election observation involves sending a group of people, a group of experts that's politically neutral, that's invited by the electoral authorities. This invitation involves taking, you know, people who's not interested in the political games of the country to observe, to analyze the electoral process, to make sure that the electoral process fulfill international standards for democratic elections, and also that the own country legislation is being respected in the electoral process. At the end of the electoral cycle, international observation mission writes a report analyzing the full electoral process and analyzing if the international standards were fulfilled or not, if the country legislation was respected, and also, and most importantly, offering suggestions to improve the electoral cycle in the future. Since the end of the Cold War, 1989, the number of countries celebrating elections around the world improved considerably. But many of these elections were not necessarily free and fair, right? Countries starting to hold elections just to signal to the international community that they were somehow democratic. But in the end, the elections were not necessarily space for the citizens to have their preferences counted for. And therefore, the practice of international observation also became more important in this scenario in which one would have to actually check if those elections being celebrated in new countries, in new places, were actually being an opportunity for the country's citizens to have their voices heard. And therefore, you know, organizations such as European Union, the Organization of American States, the Carter Center, which is the NGO in which I've been collaborating since 2022, some organizations became known and recognized as serious and professional international observers in, you know, all continents in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. And so you mentioned the international standards. How are those set? Who kind of sets the international standards?
Of course. One of the most accepted and recognized way to identify international standards for democratic elections, it's in public international law sources, like treaties, conventions, resolutions from international organizations. These sort of documents Some of them are legally binding. So if countries actually sign them, they have to respect and account for those standards. Actually, the Carter Center has a very important work in identifying such standards. I invite listeners to check the Election Obligations Handbook, which is a manual that the Carter Center developed, looking for sources of public international law in which you find which obligations are the states committing themselves with, right? Because one of the advantages of going after public international law sources for finding international standards for elections is actually you are gonna evaluate the country's commitment to democracy by standards that the countries themselves have signed to, and most of cases ratified when they sign such documents.
And how many people are involved in the process of election monitoring? So you monitored, I think you said three elections. Is it always the same number of people involved, or does it depend on the size of the country, I guess? Are you looking at the entire national process, or are you looking at just part of the national process?
Of course, there are different types of international observation missions. I would say that a full-scale mission would count with a group of experts plus several observers spread through the country to actually observe the voting process in voting stations across the country. Through time, and for each election, you have to get the resources to deploy such a mission. And sometimes that's not possible. Take a country like Brazil, for example. It's just not possible to have people spread out across the country to have a statistically representative sample of voting stations being observed. And also considering some aspects of the election itself, for example, in Brazil, we use this electronic voting system in which it's simply not, it doesn't make sense to have people just observing a machine being used by people in different places because it's the same process. So there are different types. So beyond the full scale mission, you can have an expert mission. That's what the Carter Center sent to Brazil in 2022, where I was involved, in which you have a group of experts specifically connected to like the relevant aspects of the electoral cycle in the election itself. In 2022 in Brazil, again, one of the most latent and urgent issues was the voting machines itself. They were under attacks from the then sitting president, Jair Bolsonaro, and therefore the Carter Center designed a mission that would study and specifically evaluate the design of the electronic voting system. And therefore we had election technology experts that much more interesting for the sake of understanding the design of the electronic voting system is to have election technology expert meeting with the electoral authorities, meeting with the IT folks, rather than having people spread out across the country on election day. So an international observation mission can have different formats depending on what's being observed in that particular election.
So there is that technological aspect for the Brazilian election you mentioned. I'm just wondering, you mentioned a couple things in terms of the recommendations that are produced as a result of the monitoring missions. And then also you talked about electronic voting machines, which didn't always exist, obviously. And there's maybe a two-part question here. Can you talk a little bit about some of the recommendations that came out of that Brazilian monitoring exercise? And then also maybe how the process of election monitoring has changed over, recent years since you've been involved, but I understand you've studied it as well. So maybe if you could just talk a little bit about the change in the process over time, but also maybe some of the recommendations that come out of the process.
Of course. So the Carter Center mission to Brazilian presidential election in 2022, as I said, the technology aspect was most acute in that period. The then President Bolsonaro was attacking the voting system, saying it was rigged for the then opposition. And Brazil uses the electronic voting system since the year 2000. So it's been around for a while. And for most of the time, most of these two decades, people trusted that the voting machine. People fully trusted the voting machine. And then since 2018, when the Bolsonaro then candidate started to attack the voting system, it took a lot of people to the skepticism side of things, right? They started questioning the way the system was designed, and they started raising doubts about the integrity of the voting system. And the electronic voting system in Brazil has a particular trait, which is 100% electronic. It doesn't have a voter paper trail that's actually recommended in most places that use electronic voting systems. On one hand, the TSE, the Tribunal Superior Eleitoral, which is the main electoral authority in the country, they're completely averse to reintroducing paper to the equation because they had several problems. The electronic voting system came out as a solution to having several problems with voting by paper. And they are, to this day, 100% averse to reintroducing paper into the equation. And therefore, more than suggesting, well, you should reintroduce paper to the equation, we recommended the TSC to consider new steps of auditing the voting system that would bring again those people that started questioning the electronic voting system to once again believe in the system. You have to conquer back, you have to reconquer their belief in the electronic system. So that's something that we didn't basically suggest reintroduce paper or adapt a paper trail to your voting machines, but you have, well, think about ways of conquering back the
Right.
confidence of people. Yeah.
Reestablishing the con. Yeah.
Reestablishing the confidence, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the second question, I'm sorry, James. Oh, how observation changed through time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I would say that to this day, so when this all started in the 1990s, the information environment in general was completely different from what we have today, right? One of the main things that the international observation missions have to offer to society in general, to political stakeholders, to political candidates, to the citizens in which we are observing the election, is to provide information about the electoral process, whether the legislation was fulfilled, if international standards were attended, et cetera, et cetera. To these days, information evolves and changes, and we are constantly being attacked by information coming everywhere. So this changes a little bit what we have to offer, right? So rather than having simply a final statement, a final report on how the electoral process went, we have to, during the process, have a communication strategy that would provide citizens with information about the process. And that's not necessarily, and that's a very sensitive thing to do because we don't want to be involved in the process. We don't want to interfere in the process while we're doing observations. We have to be neutral. We have to be 100% unrelated to what's going on. But in a situation in which, for example, if there is a serious fake news, if there is a serious piece of misinformation that's already impacting the political scenario, the political debate before the elections, international observation missions to this day started to coming out and say, well, that's false. That's most of the times we're just, echoing the electoral authorities because we work in cooperation with electoral authorities all the time. And again, as we don't want to interfere, we have just to back up the official information about the electoral process. But that's something that's changed. The way we communicate and the way our work tries to lighten the political debate around the elections. In terms of technology being implemented, because the question came from when we were discussing technology, and I would say that there was a boom on e-voting solutions in the late 90s and early 2000s, but that boom is no longer out there. Some developed high-income countries are completely averse to e-voting as well. And that's because, to vote, you only need paper. That's the most credible and reliable way of doing an election. Once you introduce technology, once you introduce a voting machine, for example, you lose most of the citizens because they don't understand what's going on inside that little box. And that's just too complicated. If you are in a country that you can hold elections without voting technologies, voting machines, that's for the best for the country because people will be able to see that their vote was casted properly, their vote was recorded properly, and the vote was counted properly as well. And that's something that you cannot assure or make the average citizen know the process that it goes through once they cast their vote in a voting machine, right?
Interesting. And of course, we saw the doubt being cast on voting systems in the US election in 2020. And it's interesting because as a Canadian, for our federal elections and provincial elections, we use paper only. But it's a hybrid for municipal, we use machines. But there's always paper backup. How many, do you know roughly how many jurisdictions or what proportion use voting machines versus paper?
75% of the countries, and that's international IDS data, 75% of the countries doesn't use electronic solutions for voting in any sort of elections taking place in their country. So you've mentioned that Canada using municipal elections, that's not one of those countries. But 75% of the whole country doesn't use any form of e-voting. So one in every four countries uses some form of e-voting in their elections. Australia also uses it for municipal and local elections. And you have, of course, like Philippines, Indonesia, Brazil, and India, major democracies that use electronic voting formats. Some of the most critical voices of the electronic voting here in Brazil today, they usually go through this argument, right? Well, you have developed countries like Finland, the UK, Norway, and they don't need, they don't use voting. Why do we have to use them? And the answer to that is pretty simple. I mean, the technological solution only comes out when there is a necessity of doing so. Brazil is an underdeveloped country which had several problems with electoral fraud using paper votes in the 1990s. And therefore, the TSE, our electoral authority, developed the voting as a solution to this issue, to this problem. So you won't see Norway going after e-voting solutions because they don't have issues voting with paper, right?
And so, yeah, I wonder, yeah, I'm wondering how that's evolving over the world in terms of the voting process, in terms of how many countries are maybe considering either changing to e-voting or switching back to paper. Is there any talk about that? Is there a trend going on either way?
I think the trend is anti e-voting right now. I think there aren't many places that are considering reintroducing e-vote or introduce for the first time e-voting because there's this general zeitgeist that's against it. Something that's being developed, I mean, and I would say that's interesting to talk about would be voting through internet, which is being the Mexican elections this year. They had they provided for the first time the possibility for Mexicans abroad to vote through internet, and that's something new. Of course, there's this great debate on ensuring the safety of the process, ensuring that how vulnerable it is to hack attacks or cyber threats. And you also have Estonia, which is I would say that the country that's by far adopting internet voting for all citizens already. It's a complex system. I'm sure it involves, detailed pros and cons. But I would say that if there is news coming from alternative voting methods involving technology, that will be it. That will be voting th through internet. But I'm sure it's not for everyone and everywhere.
And from your understanding, when there are problems with the conduct of an election, what's the most common source of those problems?
Well, bad actors for sure. Bad actors uninterested with citizens' preference being summed up on an electoral outcome, and that will happen like in many different levels. It will come from a political leader who will simply attack the electoral authorities, and that's becoming much more common in these days. They just want to bring noise to the electoral process. They just want to shoot the referee. In case they lose the elections, but you can watch out. Once they win the election, all the doubts regarding the electoral referees are just washed away. So bad actors, I would say that's one of the main oranges of problems around elections. But that's not everywhere. Something that's everywhere, and that's a challenge that I was thinking about these days. That's irrespectively of political regime, of income level, or whatever. Myth and disinformation is the problem that affects elections that takes place everywhere. And that's something that we're still figuring out how to deal with. It's a very sensitive topic because the electoral authorities have to cooperate with social media platforms, and they're not always interested or willing to engage in this debate. But I would say that's a common problem that affects elections taking place everywhere, myth and disinformation.
And that would be, I'm assuming, it's a more of a recent phenomenon since, social media rose and Historically, I guess misinformation is always there, but there's just so many avenues now for the misinformation to propagate. And you said, I guess, during the election process, if there's a particular piece of misinformation that's propagating and you're doing the monitoring, how do the monitors respond to that particular piece, that may be particularly consequential?
So these will be the myths and disinformation related to official electoral information. So, for example, if there is a widely spread message on social media that says that, well, voting is not taking place on Sunday, rather on Saturday or Monday, and that's a very important piece of information that can actually, subvert people's rights to vote. So that's one of the situations in which the electoral monitors can and should actually speak up. Again, echoing the electoral authority's official information. So basically information related to voter identification on voting day, the day and place of the election. Important, but related to the process information only. If there is information regarding one of the candidates, we're not in the position of taking place to and trying to make it write that message because we shouldn't be perceived as helping candidate A or B, but rather information regarding the process, regarding the electoral authority, regarding the act of voting. That's when international monitors should speak up.
Interesting. And so you worked for the Carter Center, and President Carter, I guess, not long after he left office in 1980, started observing elections. What's your understanding of the change in the process, say, over the past number of decades, since he started? Obviously, we now have technology that, they didn't have back then in terms of facilitating the monitoring process, but generally, what have been the big changes in the election monitoring process since he started that initiative?
Of course, so President Carter was one of the main and leading voices in making the act of election monitoring and electoral observation become international norm in the 1990s. I would say some technological advances in international observation missions are mostly related to the way we collect data. Of course, people started doing that, collecting data on like observing in the field, the E-Day process. With paper forms, and now we use softwares in our phones, software that doesn't need data signal to work because most of the times we're observing in places where there's not internet connectivity. The different formats of electoral observation missions that I was mentioning before, I think that's also something that changed through time because before we needed to be out there, we needed to be in the field, we needed to be perceived and seen as well. That's the electoral observers. They are monitoring the process. We can trust them, etc. And now our presence can be felt and presented to the public by different means, including social media. And also, so I'll say that's something. And to that end, we can have an expert Mueller mission that would have a specific interest in the electoral process instead of just watching E-Day and making sure people are not stuffing ballot boxes and people are not voting twice or whatever. So the practice of electoral observation changed as the way also that fraud and manipulation also change, right? Because before the most common way of stealing an election would be to stuff ballot boxes with fake votes, use people to vote more than one time, actually steal ballot boxes completely, and also just changing the results when you're counting the votes. But these practices, including because the practice of electoral observation become much more common, autocrats and undemocratic leaders had to change the way they rigged elections. And they are now, to this day, relying on more sophisticated techniques, I would say, in which you twist, you rig the electoral playing field months before the election takes place, right? You can change the electoral rules. You can ban political candidates from the opposition that are an actual threat on your chances of winning the election. You can spread mis and disinformation regarding your opponents, hoping that that would, fundamentally change the way citizens perceive them. So there are more sophisticated techniques, and therefore, due to that, international observation missions to these days must start way earlier than they used to, right? So missions to this day can be deployed months before E-Day to watch the process, to follow the news daily, to see what's going on in the place, to start meeting with electoral stakeholders to understand what are the threats, what's going on to this day, since we are weeks or months before the election, what is the government trying to do to the electoral rules, to the electoral authorities in trying to make sure that they're going to win the election. So since electoral fraud and manipulation changed, so did observation missions in adapting to new forms of monitoring and making sure that international standards are being fulfilled.
So you were involved in monitoring elections in Brazil, Tunisia, and Venezuela, I understand. And I guess in terms of the different historical contexts of these countries, some maybe have longer standing democracies, some newer democracies. And then there's also the cultural differences, I guess, between the countries. Does that call for a different process of monitoring just based on the history and the different cultural situation?
That's a very good question, James, because we observe considering the international standards, and the international standards should apply to, everyone everywhere. Of course, we consider cultural particularities when we're doing our work. For example, a mission deployed to Venezuela, it can easily be set up with a full Spanish-speaking expert that will monitor their election and that will, simply talk with electoral stakeholders, with the authorities, and understand the process fully. A mission to Tunisia on the other side, it's more hard to set up. And therefore, in terms of my personal experience in all these elections, I would say that to have an interpreter with me all the time changed considerably the way I was doing my work in a country like Tunisia. And inside one specific country, you can also find fundamentally differences depending on where you are. So when I was in the capital in Tunis, most people spoke French, so it was easier to get around. But once you go to the countryside, the landscape changes considerably. To me, it was the first Arabic country I was ever been to. And in Tunisia, you felt like you were, in a Mediterranean city, very cosmopolitan. And once you go to the countryside, it's very much different from what I'm used to as a, a Brazilian man on his 30s. So I think that was a very personal reaction to your question. But going back to your question, so we do observe considering international standards, and those international standards should apply everywhere. But a little bit more on international standards as well. I mean, international standards are basically making sure human rights are being fulfilled during the electoral process. And this involves universal suffrage, one person, one vote, right to have a remedy if one of your electoral rights wasn't respected through the process. So we're not it's not necessarily high developed country standards that a country like Venezuela or Tunisia or Brazil wouldn't fulfill. I mean, they're supposed to, especially because there are signatures of international treaties that already predict and expect that you would fulfill such human rights.
I guess, yeah, applying kind of these universal standards to countries that don't have such a long experience with voting, I guess, could be more difficult and involve, I guess, more people and more oversight.
Yeah, for example, all the work that the Carter Center has done in Tunisia. So the Carter Center was there after the Arab Spring, and it had an office there. And the office, beyond monitoring elections, it had human rights and civil society strengthening activities and projects there, because that was for the first time Tunisia was becoming democratic. And so international organizations from all types and colors tried to help that process. Unfortunately, the process in Tunisia is taking the other direction in the last few years, and the center had to close its office there because there was not, apparently, from what the center was getting from the society and from the political actors, the leading political actors, the democratic route, as we understand it, was not being what the people wanted at that point, at that moment. It is challenging to work in countries that are, you know, establishing their institutions for the first time, and you sometimes you run into this sort of situation.
Is there any personal danger to the people observing the elections? Are there threats made?
I think my experience in Venezuela would be something to reference here, because Venezuela was a very political sensitive election that took place in July this year, in which the political regime had a, you know, the Chavista regime, Maduro, had a real challenge, electoral challenge, coming from the opposition. And months before the election, the OAS, the Organization of American States, released an advisory opinion on international observers are human rights defenders and they should be perceived as such. And, you know, nothing can happen with them as they're doing their work because they're there and trying to make human rights being respected. And then the Venice Commission actually last week echoed this OAS, the Venice Commission, which is the European Union Commission on Human Rights. Echoed that opinion and also said that, well, international observers are human rights defenders and should be perceived and respected as such. Because you're there that the election is going to be democratic, or at least monitoring the election and telling people later, afterwards, if it was democratic or not, right? And we were in Venezuela to watch the election. We observed, we spent a month there and we watched the vote on July 28th. And at the night of the July 28th, the electoral authority announced a result that was not being confirmed by the information that some civil society organizations had from the ground. In Venezuela, each voting station prints the vote results of that particular voting machine. And once you sum up a great part of those electoral tallies at the end of the voting, you had one result and the electoral authority announced another one. And we had to think what we're going to do on that situation because we had something to say about the electoral process on whether it was democratic or not. But meanwhile, you would watch the television and you would see that the government was trying to, you know, just announcing a result that they couldn't confirm or they couldn't present further evidence that that was actually the result, as they haven't done up to this date. So we had to evacuate the country. We had to evacuate the country because we did not know what could happen with us, since, you know, journalists, foreign journalists that were in our own hotel were being kidnapped, I would say, and taken back to their countries. That happened in the hotel we were in Caracas. So that was a little bit terrifying, and we had to, you know, made the decision of just, you know, evacuating the country before something happened to us. So there are threats, there are dangers. We are there representing the voice of the international community, and we could be perceived sometimes also by political stakeholders as being representative of, I would say, what the Chavistas would call us in Venezuela, from the Yankees, from the imperialism, right? So at some point, we thought that our security was at risk.
Yeah, and we're glad that you were safe. But it's an interesting situation because, of course, you know, across the world, we looked at the Venezuelan election, the lead up to it, you know, the chance that there might actually be a change, and then the result, which a lot of people doubt that it was a legitimate result. I don't know whether it was or wasn't, but there is this lingering doubt. In that case, I mean, with the Venezuelan government seem to have a vested interest in ensuring its survival from the outset. Was it the Venezuelan Election Authority, was it clearly separate from the government in terms of wanting a clear result? Or was, I'm just wondering how you got invited to observe that election in the first place.
The Carter Center was invited by the Electoral Authority, which by the Constitution is autonomous independent body, but in practice it isn't. The government controls the institution, and but the reason they invited us is that our presence was much more publicized than our findings would ever be. And it's in the interest of such autocrats to be perceived as democratic. And through the whole process, the Venezuelan government thought that they could actually win with the votes, partially because through the electoral process, the process was rigged altogether. In each part that they could, benefit the government and make the life of the opposition harder, they did. So it's not only the lack of transparency in the announcement of the results. The whole process was already, biased towards the government. But, inviting international observers is a way to signal that, well, we're willing to make a democratic election. We are even inviting, the Carter Center, and we're inviting the UN panel of experts to observe the election. And our presence there, I can tell you, our presence there was pretty much publicized. When we went there for the first time to sign the memorandum of entendimento, we were everywhere in the Chavista media, right? Because that, that also sends an important signal to the own population, right? Well, our election is going to be serious and it's going to be professional because the international monitors are here. So it's interesting for them to invite us. And the Carter Center had a history already observing elections in Venezuela. President Jimmy Carter, he has access both to the government and the opposition. So it wasn't a surprise to invite the center to observe this election. But of course, our findings and our report at the end would never have as much publicity as our presence there in the first place.
Yeah, I guess that's something to be concerned about before agreeing to monitor an election is to make sure that your presence is not being used as a as a means of covering up some other activities.
Of course, of
Yeah.
course. In the same time, we were pretty much aware, I mean, that was a risk of going to Venezuela, but also it would be important to have, a voice there. It would be important to have someone there that's professional, that's doing an election monitoring based on international standards, and that could be, in position of telling the story of the election afterwards, which is actually what happened. I mean, the center was the only international observation group that was there that would have a public report afterwards. The other international monitoring group was the UN panel of experts, but their report should have been only private, delivered only to the electoral authority, which in the end they publicized it anyway. But the center was there, the center observed the election, the center was in a very good position of, telling the stories of the Venezuelan action afterwards, telling exactly what happened, telling why the actas, the voting sheets that the opposition had and made publicly available, why that information that signals that Edmundo González won that election, why that information is legitimate, why should we trust the actas that's out there, why should we question the electoral authority saying that the result that they announced is not legitimate, it's lacking transparency. So it was very important to be there, even though we knew that they could use our presence there for political benefits.
This has really been very interesting, and I understand. I guess in the time that remains, I have maybe two questions for you. So, in terms of your practical experience in monitoring elections, I wonder how that related to your PhD dissertation, which was, I understand, on electoral manipulation and democratic backsliding. Can you tell us just a little bit about how what you did in your PhD work, how that was reflected in your practical experience of monitoring the elections, what your findings were in your dissertation. And then I wanted to move from there just to maybe conclude on how technology can be used, maybe to improve the process of election monitoring and fairness.
Of course. On my dissertation, I've worked with what I called electoral autocratization, which would be to change electoral rules or to rig the election more broadly to make sure that the election, first of all, the regime is no longer a democracy. And for the regime to be considered not a democracy anymore, what I understand is that the elections cannot be won by the opposition. So I've investigated 35 cases of countries that since 1990, they crossed the line to be considered a democracy and started being considered an electoral autocracy, which is an autocracy that still runs elections, but that election cannot be won by the opposition. And I've explored what happens to the election of these 35 cases. I use a particular measure from VDEM, Varieties of Democracy, which is this institute in the University of Gothenburg that surveys experts across the globe and creates hard to measures related to democratic qualities. They have this specific categorization of political regimes, and I've investigated all the countries that crossed the line between democracy to electoral autocracy. And I've investigated what happened to the election in these cases. I found out there are, I think I categorized two main ways of, rigging the elections to make the regime to cross the line. You can either invest in E-day frauds, old style manipulation of elections, ballot box stuffing, voting twice, etc. Or you can rig the electoral playing field months before the election, changing the rules, blocking political opponents from running, etc. And I was trying to understand what makes some governments resort to this sort of, prior to the election manipulation, or when they and when they can't do that and they have to resort to E-day tactics of electoral fraud. And I found some results that resonates what the literature on democratic backsliding has been talking about. So having popular support, it's pretty much connected with, leaders that are able to change the electoral rules months before the election. And an opposition that is not radical is also related to, actually, oppositions that are radical are related to political autocrats that managed to subvert elections before E-Day. Those are the two elements that, stands out as more significant and with a stronger effect on manipulating the rules months before the elections. It's popular support and a radical opposition, because they the stakes when the stakes are so high like that, and you have popular support, people will, support your electoral reform to change electoral rules. And I would say that, to have contact with so many strategies, because, I've tried to catalog for fraud techniques. And having contact with so many, creative ways of manipulating elections that actually, made me, I would say, aware of what's out there. And I can, and I've already did, encountered in places I was observing. And I'm sorry, your final question, James, would.
The final question, I guess, is just, were there any surprises in terms of your experience observing versus your study conclusions? But also, I guess, finally, is kind of the question about how, from a philosophical standpoint, how can we balance the benefits of technology in elections, such as, increased transparency and access to information, with the risks of digital manipulation, misinformation? So, I guess maybe a two-part question there. Whether your experience turned out to be as you had thought it might be while you were studying, but also generally how we take technology and maybe employ it to the benefit of a fair process.
Sometimes I could share that I've learned, like on the ground, it became much more clear to me is that, sometimes electoral integrity is the basics. Transparency is key, and anything that we can reach out and ensuring transparency, it's what electoral integrity is all about. So you have to be transparent in the way the rules are being discussed. You have to be transparent in the way that you're implementing the rules. You have to be transparent in the way that you're presenting electoral information to the population. You have to be transparent in the results that you're announcing. And that only became, acute to me when I was on the ground and I was, dealing with people from stakeholders to voters that were, they had doubts about the process. They were kind of scared. They didn't know what's going to happen. And, if the electoral authorities can provide transparency, that is key in making the voters aware of their rights, aware of how the election takes place, how the electoral process works. So, again, that's something that came out from the ground. And on your second question on the balance between transparency and, like, I would say, digital threats in this day and age of elections. Well, I think there is a limit, because that's the $1 million question, right? That's a question that the electoral authorities everywhere are making. You have to be transparent. You have to provide information for the citizens. You have to be transparent. You know, I actually have a good example. I was discussing the other day with some other electro experts on whether EMB, electro management bodies meetings, should be public events or not. And on the one hand, it's great that we have full transparency of what's being discussed and the ideas that are being shared and debated. But on the other hand, I mean, these meetings raises issues and, you know, very delicate and sensitive topics in which sometimes, I mean, it's not for everyone. And the information that's being debated there might be actually might fuel myth and disinformation narratives or even bad actors planning on what they're gonna do. So that's one of the situations, like, you know, should EMB meetings be public? I mean, there's not a straight answer to that. In what regards to technologies being implemented right now, I would say that, again, if one is considering and implementing a new technological tool or solution to its electoral process, one has definitely to consider the risks being, is this technological solution actually solving a real problem? Or is this, I'm creating a problem and then I'm creating a solution, and this solution is actually bringing more problems into the process. And again, I bring the situation of, you know, e-voting. E-voting is not for everywhere. I mean, if you have a problem with the way you vote, you can consider implementing a digital solution to that. But if you don't have, why are you implementing such thing that might only bring, you know, a fear and people not knowing how the process actually works, and you're putting away the citizens that should be fully aware of the process and should be they should understand fully the electoral process. Technology sometimes brings, you know, unnecessary elements to the equation.
Yeah, the EMB meeting was a public meeting. That's a really interesting example to think about, and the benefits and the drawbacks of that. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, maybe as you said earlier, it's a question of ensuring that whatever happens, that the voters themselves believe in the process, which is maybe the most important thing. And I guess there's no right or wrong answer. It maybe just depends on the context and the players involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And beyond transparency, which was one of the elements I've said that I've learned on the ground, that that's one of a fundamental thing that actually matters. I would add trust. Trust. People have to trust the process. People have to trust the electoral authorities, and people have to trust that the process is being fair, free from interference, and that in the end, their voices are going to be heard through the election.
Yeah, and technology can be used either for the benefit of trust or against trust. So, yeah. Well, Ian, thank you so much for this discussion. It's been a real learning experience for me to understand how the process works, how it's changed, the thinking behind it, how it's evolved. So, thank you very much. And yeah, we'll be very interested to see how future elections turn out and how the technological piece in particular plays out. So, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, James. I really appreciate it.
Our thanks go to today's guest and to you for listening to the Quantum Feedback Loop. Please subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to check out The Quantum Record at thequantumrecord.com. The Quantum Record is a monthly journal of philosophy, science, technology, and time, where you'll find the latest developments in our rapidly evolving technological world.